VE Day, the surrender of the Nazi regime in Germany. That's the focus of this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
From the Mutual Newsroom in New York, a bulletin from London, a French communique broadcast by the Paris radio said today that a truce has been concluded in the battle for the French Atlantic port of La Rochelle and that the Germans have returned 175 French prisoners. And, of course, you heard the earlier bulletin. The BBC recorded at 8.09 a.m. Eastern Wartime a Radio Flensburg German broadcast quoting the German foreign minister as announcing that the German high command accepts unconditional surrender. The Flensburg radio on the German-Danish border said the German surrender decision was reported by Count Ludwig Schwerin von Krosigk, German foreign minister appointed only last week. More news as fast as it is received. Now back to the program in progress.
That bulletin was heard over the Mutual Radio Network on the morning of the 7th of May, 1945. The Allied announcement of the surrender of the Nazis, ending the European conflict in the Second World War, would officially come the following day, but an Associated Press reporter let the news slip past the official embargo. As a result, many celebrated the news over a dozen hours before Washington, London, and Moscow made the official proclamations. For an explanation of what happened, we have here two local radio newscasts from that 7th of May. First, the noon hour newscast over KOIN in Portland, Oregon. And then the John Vandevender news and commentary as heard that evening over WOR in New York City and relayed over the Mutual Network.
12 o'clock Binion News, the service of Binion optometrists. While much of the Allied world is already celebrating VE Day, the official announcement that the war in Europe has ended will not be made until tomorrow. The British Ministry of Information announced less than an hour and a half ago that tomorrow will be VE Day. Just an hour ago, President Truman announced in Washington that he has agreed with London and Moscow to make no announcement on the final surrender of Germany until a simultaneous announcement can be made by the three Allied governments. The British Ministry of Information said that Prime Minister Winston Churchill would broadcast at 3 p.m. British time. That's 6 a.m. Pacific wartime. King George will speak to the British people at 9 p.m. British time, which is 12 noon Pacific wartime. Earlier, CBS correspondent Edward Murrow in London said that President Truman and Prime Minister Churchill were ready to announce the official news of the German surrender at 9 a.m. today, but he said that they were delayed because Premier Stalin, scheduled to speak at the same time, was not ready. In Washington, arrangements have been made for President Truman to go on the air whenever he is ready to issue a VE Day proclamation. Broadcasting equipment has been made ready in the White House diplomatic room, from which presidential broadcasts are usually made. On Capitol Hill, radio receiving equipment has been set up in the House of Representatives so that representatives can remain in their seats when Mr. Truman makes his VE declaration. The first Associated Press flash from Reims in France saying that Germany had surrendered was followed 2 hours later by a broadcast by ABSI, the American broadcasting station in Europe. Supreme Headquarters, in the meantime, had issued a statement not denying the truth of the AP flash, but saying that no official announcement had been authorized. The broadcast by ABSI, however, called it official. The government-operated station gave the same details that AP Western European Chief Edward Kennedy had sent earlier from Reims. Later, Supreme Headquarters announced that it had not made any official statement concerning the surrender, but did not deny the truth of Kennedy's story. It said Lieutenant General Walter Smith signed on behalf of General Eisenhower, and two representatives of the German General Staff had accepted the terms of unconditional surrender. Like Kennedy, ABSI said that representatives of Russia and France also signed the document, agreed to by the new German Army Chief of Staff, Colonel General Gustav Jodl. Kennedy's dramatic account told how the surrender was signed in the Reims schoolhouse. Lieutenant General Walter Smith signed as representative of General Eisenhower. The document was signed by General Ivan Sushloparov for Russia and by General François Sivez for France. After giving these details, ABSI appealed to the people of liberated Europe to think today of the Americans who lie beside their own men on the battlefield. Think of these Americans as being your dead too, said Absey. You who were enslaved are free, and the men who belong to Kansas and New York and Mississippi will not turn homeward, but eastward to the last battleground in Asia. So far, the Associated Press is the only news service to carry the story from Reims telling of the final German surrender. Neither the United Press nor INS has carried the story. How the AP managed to get the story through censorship is not known. Meanwhile, Supreme Allied Headquarters announced that the filing facilities of the Associated Press have been suspended throughout the entire European theater of operations. Earlier, an announcement was made stating that the AP's filing privileges at Supreme Allied Headquarters had been suspended. AP Headquarters in New York did not comment on the announcement. News of the final German surrender set off mass celebrations in scores of cities throughout the Allied world. In London, thousands of American soldiers cheered and embraced each other in a manner reminiscent of triumphant football crowds. A sign was posted at the biggest Red Cross club in London, informing American Army personnel that upon official notice of VE Day, all passes and furloughs are to be extended 48 hours. Throughout the United States, America has greeted the news with shouts of jubilation and quiet prayers of thanks. New York's famous Times Square has been roped off, and all vehicular traffic was stopped in the financial district. Thousands left their offices to parade on the streets with flags and banners. Meanwhile, there are reports that fighting is still in progress on the European continent. Czechoslovakian sources in London say it's possible that tank vanguards of the American Third Army have entered Prague. At the last unofficial report, the Third Army was within 12 and a half miles of the Czech capital. The Swedish Home Radio Service said that an Allied naval force of 48 ships has been sighted at the entrance to Oslo Fjord and that a landing on Norwegian soil is expected at any moment. Marshal Stalin announced in an order of the day that Russian troops have captured Breslau. Another war criminal has been captured and another Allied hero has been liberated. Allied troops have found Anton Musert, the leader of the Dutch Nazi Party, at his headquarters in Utrecht, Holland. Musert, one of Holland's most hated traitors, is believed to be in good health. At the same time, it's disclosed that the former premier of Austria, Kurt Schuschnigg, has been liberated from a German concentration camp. In newly surrendered Denmark, Danish patriots have arrested 2,500 collaborators in their first 2 days of search. Sporadic shooting still is going on in the streets of Copenhagen. Elsewhere on the European news front, Spain severed diplomatic relations with Germany. The official announcement was made only 24 hours after Portugal's break with the beaten Nazi government. The unofficial announcement of the long-anticipated surrender of Germany was received calmly among the Navy, Army, and Marine forces in the Pacific. Men on the midnight watch aboard ships were the first to hear the report of Grand Armor Karl Dönitz's capitulation, but the news in many cases was broadcast immediately over ship and shore station loudspeakers shortly after midnight. Headquarters spokesman, however, declined to make a statement on reports of the unconditional surrender until official announcement had been made in Washington. Admiral Nimitz recently pointed out at Okinawa that the Pacific forces will welcome the help of United States airmen employed in Europe. All Pacific fighting men, admittedly, will greet the German conquerors with open arms. None, however, anticipates an immediate turn of events in the Pacific. They know it will require months to shift Yank power across the Atlantic. Australian forces on Tarakan Island have a big cleanup job on their hands on that tiny island just off oil-rich Borneo. At Tarakan City, the retreating Japs left behind an elaborate network of heavily defended tunnels. In one dugout, the Aussies found enough shells, booby traps, and landmines to blow up an entire mountain ridge. Bomb disposal squads effectively neutralized the position. Japan's airdromes and shipping in waters near the enemy's homeland were targets for a two-phased air assault which achieved what were described as good results. One phase of the attacks was a strike by naval planes which destroyed or damaged 20 Japanese surface vessels in historic Tsushima and Korea Straits, as well as off the west coast of Korea. On the domestic news front in Washington, the United States Supreme Court ruled that the federal wage hour law requires soft coal miners to be paid portal-to-portal travel time wages. The High Court issued its ruling in a 5-4 decision in the case of the Jewel Ridge Coal Corporation, operator of two bituminous mines in southwestern Virginia. The firm had appealed from a decision of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which decreed that coal miners must be paid portal-to-portal wages. At the White House, President Truman broke his usual custom of taking a brisk walk to his temporary residence, Blair House, for lunch. The president remained in his White House office and apparently had lunch at his desk. Former war mobilizer James Burns is scheduled to visit the White House today for the first time since shortly after President Truman took office. Burns had been at his home in South Carolina since his initial talk with the president. War Manpower Commission officials predicted that the end of the war in Europe will mean that the 48-hour work week will be suspended in areas where the labor market has loosened up. They say VE Day probably also will mean that controls will be lifted on workers who are frozen on their present jobs. President Truman assured the governors of all the states that he wants to cooperate with them as much as possible during his administration. The president's desire to cooperate was expressed in a letter to the governors from Mr. Truman's new chief administrative assistant, Edward McKim. Effective today, the OPA is banning retail sales of all unpackaged cigarettes. This forbids the sale of loose cigarettes at one penny each, a custom which the OPA says resulted in unnecessarily high prices. At Camp Edwards, Massachusetts, military discipline has caught up with a young WAC who overstayed her honeymoon leave after marrying a prison convict. Private Mary Bailey is confined to quarters. The bridegroom, John Bailey, also has his troubles. On leave from Arkansas Penitentiary so he could marry, Bailey was unable to find a room. So he's staying at the home of a policeman's mother near Camp Edwards. Here in the Pacific Northwest, Colonel Elmer Wooten, Oregon draft director, said that victory in Europe will have no effect on draft procedure in Oregon, where about 600 men are being inducted each month. Virtually all men now being drafted in the state are from 18 to 30 and not engaged in essential industry, Wooten said after his return from a Washington conference. He disclosed that because of the high rejection rate, about 1,200 men a month are being called for examination. Essential farmers for whom no replacements can be found still are being deferred, whatever their age. Officials of the Portland Retail Trade Bureau announced that its member stores will not close for VE Day until the official proclamation is made. Similar announcement was made by the independent food stores. School officials said that the city's schools would not close even after the proclamation is received. Instead, the school children will attend special VE Day programs in Portland schools. Nampa, Idaho has already had its VE Day celebration. The Western Idaho Railroad Center held religious services Sunday, at which the pastor of the Christian Church, the Reverend Lester Jones, declared, "Winning the peace will be a bigger job than winning the war." The chairman of the observance, Harold Jones, explained that citizens decided to get the celebration over with because they expect to continue their regular duties when the victory announcement comes. Back in Portland, a civilian pilot, David Hale Huntley, 28, of Spokane, was fatally injured this morning when his plane crashed east on a flight from Eugene to Troutdale. Huntley suffered a fractured skull, compound leg fracture, and internal injuries and died on the way to a hospital. He was an employee of the Portland-Seattle Auto Freight Company working from Seattle. The sheriff's office at Lakeview, Oregon, is investigating an explosion which late Saturday killed a woman and five children some 15 miles east of Bly, which is on the highway between Lakeview and Klamath Falls. Two Ohio soldiers and their wives drowned Sunday in Liberty Lake near Spokane when a wave threw them 20 feet from their motorboat. The public relations office at Geiger Field identified the dead as Private Charles Neidhard, age 26, and his wife Betty Lorraine, 22. Private First Class Clarence O'Brien, 26, and his wife Geraldine, 30. Two men who confessed that they burglarized the Richland, Washington Bank of $2,500 were sentenced Saturday to penitentiary terms by the Federal District Court in Yakima. While announcement of VE Day in Europe is being held up until tomorrow, VE Day in the Pacific War Theater is definitely not in sight. The fight there is a tough one. It will cost many lives before it's won. But many men who might otherwise die can be saved by blood donations. You can help speed VE Day in the Pacific by donating a pint of your blood. For an appointment at the Red Cross Blood Donor Center in Portland, call Atwater, 8561. Atwater, 8561. Your pint of blood can save a fighting man's life. The weather forecast for Portland and vicinity continued fair and warm today and Tuesday. Highest temperature this afternoon, about 82. Remember, the Binion optometrists, who have served as friendly guardians of vision for more than 2.5 decades, bring you these daily news broadcasts. Tune in tomorrow at 12 noon for your Binion News with Lou Gillette reporting. Duncan MacLeod speaking from KOIN Portland. Transcribed.
Vandeventer reports the latest worldwide news prepared and edited in the WOR newsroom. Brought to you by the brewers of Hoffman Beer. And now here is Vandeventer with the latest news.
In many respects, this has been a lamentable day, despite the fact that it's been celebrated throughout much of the world as VE Day. There seems to be no doubt but what the Germans have surrendered unconditionally. The Germans admit it, and it's not denied by any official sources. And yet, it's a lamentable day. Millions of American troops have fought a magnificent fight. They were joined by millions of Russians and millions of British, French, and other national groups. Germany has been brought to her knees. And yet, through some unfortunate quirk of fate, the whole beautiful effort of General Eisenhower and his staff has ended on a note of discord. It must be fairly obvious to everyone at this hour that despite the celebrations, despite the news, and despite the lack of official denials, that this has not been VE Day. Millions of lives have been lost to bring the Germans to their knees. For a little more than 3 years, the troops and their commanders have lived for the day when German generals would sign the unconditional surrender papers. There's no doubt that they prepared for it. There can be little doubt but what they had thought out in a complete way. All of the details which would be best for the American people and for the world at large. And yet there was that quirk of fate which is jarring the war to its end. Here's what happened. Edward J. Kennedy, the chief of the Associated Press Bureau in Paris, telephoned to the London Bureau of the AP this morning with the announcement that the war is over and that the Germans surrendered at 8:41 New York time last night. He gave the details. The surrender was signed for the Germans by Colonel General Jodl. For General Eisenhower, by his chief of staff, Lieutenant General Smith. A French and a Russian general added their signatures. The terms were signed in a little red schoolhouse in Reims, France, where General Eisenhower had his headquarters. Kennedy's story contains a statement made by General Jodl. He had his information, and there's little reason to doubt that he had it all correctly. But it was not supposed to be released. Whether he made the mistake or whether some army officer made the mistake is beside the point. It was not supposed to have been made public in any way which would have given it the appearance of authenticity. Maybe Kennedy was overzealous to get the news out. Maybe it had been given to him by some underling in press relations. Any one of dozens of things might have happened, but none of them should have happened. It must be borne in mind that General Eisenhower has said several times that when VE Day comes, it will be announced by the chiefs of state, meaning President Truman, Prime Minister Churchill, and Premier Stalin. It would not be announced until all fighting had stopped. And he said the troops in the field would know of the surrender before the people at home. And there's a reason for that. It takes time to inform troops in the field. Fighting went on today in Czechoslovakia, and it's quite likely that some American casualties were suffered. Therefore, hostilities had not ended. General Eisenhower wanted none of the casualty telegrams to be delivered from Europe after the announcement of victory. From the very day on which he was named Commander-in-Chief of the Allied Forces, he has fought this war to save every possible Allied life. He has fought the war to bring it to a successful conclusion and no doubt had prayed for this day when the Germans surrendered. He wouldn't want it confused by a premature announcement. And yet, that's what happened. There is, of course, some supposition that Premier Stalin has forced the withholding of the announcement. A definite statement was made to the effect that President Truman and Prime Minister Churchill were ready to make the announcement at noon today, but that Stalin said that he wasn't ready. President Truman said that he had an agreement to say nothing until all three could announce it at once. During the afternoon, the British Ministry of Information announced that Prime Minister Churchill would make a statement at 9 o'clock this morning, New York time, and said further that tomorrow will be considered VE Day in the British Isles. That tended to confirm rather than to deny the Associated Press report. There still was no announcement from the White House until 7 o'clock tonight, when it was stated that Mr. Truman will speak at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. That broadcast will be carried by WOR, and presumably it will be the announcement we've been waiting for. Mr. Truman's broadcast will be followed by a transcribed broadcast from London by Mr. Churchill. If Mr. Stalin also broadcasts, that also will be transcribed and rebroadcast by WOR. Thus, it's lamentable that the war has been brought to its conclusion on such a note of discord. It has done nothing more than excite the press, the American people, and raise a barrier. Tonight and throughout the day, the White House has been flooded with telegrams from editors throughout the nation complaining about the treatment at the hands of the military in Paris. They objected to the lifting of filing privileges for all of the Associated Press. They charged the action at Supreme Allied Headquarters was a violation of the fundamental rights of free press. And during the evening, the restrictions on the AP were lifted for all of their correspondents but Mr. Kennedy. I have no way of knowing at this moment who is responsible for the error and the mix-up, but it certainly is unfortunate. During the day, there's been general celebrating here in New York, in Paris, and in London, where the news was accepted as gospel. Some of the smaller towns in Washington and on the West Coast, there was less rejoicing. They apparently waited for the official announcement. Today, Times Square in New York was jammed by a shouting, milling throng of thousands upon thousands of persons. Many of them were much the worse for drink. Some persons were injured, either in the joyous celebration, but only a few arrests were made. Tomorrow, New York City schools will be open as usual, regardless of the official announcement. Schools in smaller communities likewise will follow regular schedules. On the battlefronts today, there also have been developments. There has been serious fighting between German troops in Prague and the partisan forces. Tonight, General Patton's 4th Armored Division is less than 6 miles from the city limits of Prague. It's pushing ahead against amazingly slight resistance to go to the rescue of the embattled citizen army. The German commanding these troops is reported to have defied the order of Admiral Dönitz that the German troops lay down their arms and submit to unconditional surrender. He was quoted as saying on a German-controlled radio station that he intends to fight until the path is cleared for him to return to his homeland and liberate the Germans from Bolshevism. But he has a rather hopeless job ahead of him. The situation is not quite clear in Norway. The Germans there are reported to have given in under the Dönitz command, and there was one report late this afternoon which said that these German forces were prepared to march into neutral Sweden to be interned. No official announcement has been made on that action. However, there are reports tonight that an Allied fleet has entered Oslo Harbor and that Allied troops are about to be landed. They perhaps have landed already. Another Allied fleet is reported entering Trondheim Harbor. A late report from Paris tonight says that the King and Queen of Belgium have been liberated by the United States 7th Army from their prison quarters 8 miles east of Salzburg. And so the European phase of the greatest war in history already has, or soon will, come to an end. But in the Pacific, there's still much fighting ahead. The Japanese realize that the world is against them, but are preparing to fight to the end. Japanese positions in the southern sector of Okinawa have been brought under American guns, and the 1st Marines and 10th Infantry troops have scored new advances. And thus it is that all over the world tonight, the forces of the United Nations are one day closer to victory. King George VI, in a dramatic message to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, congratulated the Supreme Allied Commander tonight on the complete and crushing victory over Germany. His telegram said, and I quote, 11 months ago, you led the Allied Expeditionary Force across the English Channel, carrying with you the hopes and the prayers of millions of men and women of many nations. To it was entrusted the task of annihilating the German armies in Western Europe and thus liberating the peoples whom they had enslaved. All the world knows that, after fierce and continuous warfare, this force has accomplished its mission with a finality achieved by no other such expedition in history. On behalf of all my peoples, I ask that you, its supreme commander, will tell its members how deeply grateful we are to them and how unbounded is our admiration for the courage and determination which, under wise leadership, have brought them to their goal of complete and crushing victory. Here at home, President Truman has won a hands-down victory in the Senate on his biggest appointment so far. The Senate has confirmed 60-2 Mr. Truman's nomination of Robert Hannegan as Postmaster General. The overwhelming vote followed an attempt by Republicans to force public hearings on Hannegan's appointment. Republican Senator Forrest Donald of Missouri demanded the hearings on several grounds. For one thing, Senator Donald contended that Hannegan has decided to continue serving as chairman of the Democratic National Committee. This, according to Donald, is a job not compatible with the position of Postmaster General. Donald also claimed that a series of incidents in Missouri demonstrate Hannegan's unfitness for office. But when the motion for the hearings was put to a vote, the Democrats defeated it 35-28 with the voting along strict party lines. Some minority members of the Senate indicate that they may bring charges of political corruption against Hannegan in a move to block his taking office. These senators, fearful that Hannegan, as Postmaster General, may organize a political machine to aid the president if he seeks re-election, are expected to concentrate their fire on Hannegan's career in Missouri, where he was associated with the Pendergast machine. Elsewhere in the capital today, the Navy announced a plan to replace some 25,000 enlisted men, more than 42 years old, with younger men during the next 6 months. At the same time, military observers believe that most of the soldiers who have been overseas since the early part of 1943 or during that are being discharged after VE Day. Soon after VE Day, the 48-hour work week will be suspended in certain areas where the labor market has loosened up. The War Manpower Commission also may lift controls on workers now frozen in their jobs. United Mine Worker boss John L. Lewis has won one of labor's longest fights. The Supreme Court has given legal recognition to portal-to-portal pay. The court ruled the soft coal producers are required by the wage hour law to pay their miners for underground travel time. Meanwhile, in New York, hard coal operators and the United Mine Workers held another non-productive two-hour meeting today. There still is no sign of an agreement on a new work contract. The negotiations will be resumed tomorrow afternoon. Meanwhile, 72,000 miners in the hard coal fields are staying away from their jobs despite a government order that they get back to work. The work stoppage began last Tuesday when the work contract expired. The government seized the mines last Thursday. Neither the operators nor the miners' representatives would make any comment at the end of today's negotiation. Meanwhile, a holiday in the sale of kosher poultry was started today by more than 90% of New York City's 5,000 dealers. That's according to an industry spokesman. This spokesman added that it would continue until dealers could buy and sell at ceiling prices. Receipts at the city's live poultry terminal dropped 46% below those of last Monday as raisers anticipated the dealers' action and shipped much of their poultry to other cities. Now here's a brief recapitulation of the news at this hour. There has been a premature announcement of VE Day, but both President Truman and Prime Minister Churchill are expected to clarify the announcement at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, and their words will be broadcast by WOR. There has been general celebrating in New York, Paris, and London, but many smaller communities took the victory announcement in stride. There's still a war in the Pacific to be fought, and it will be long and hard. There was heavy fighting around Prague and Czechoslovakia tonight, and the Allied fleets are reported to have arrived in Oslo and Trondheim harbors. Some German fleet units are reported still holding out in Copenhagen. Here at home, the President has won a victory in the confirmation of Robert Hannigan as Postmaster General, and the Navy has announced a plan to replace older men in the sea service as soon as possible. And that's the news at this hour. And now here's Bob Martin for the Hoffman Beverage Company.
Democracy is on the march the world over, and the Greater New York Fund is an example of democracy in action locally. A gift to this year's campaign aids the 408 local hospitals, health and welfare agencies participating in the fund. Support the Greater New York Fund with your contribution. Listen to Van Deventer with the latest news every evening at 11 o'clock. Brought to you Monday, Wednesday, and Friday by the Hoffman Beverage Company of Newark, New Jersey, a member of the United States Brewers Foundation. This is Bob Martin speaking.
The Herald Tribune news will be heard following station identification. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
John Van Deventer's news and commentary over WOR New York City on the 7th of May, 1945. I'm King David McKenzie, and this is Echoes of a Century. The following morning, President Harry S. Truman took to the air at 9 a.m. Eastern Wartime and made the statement everyone was waiting to hear.
Good morning from the White House in Washington. Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
This is a solemn but a glorious hour. I only wish that Franklin D. Roosevelt had lived to witness this day. General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations. The flags of freedom fly all over Europe.
At the same time, similar radio broadcasts were made by Winston Churchill in London and Joseph Stalin in Moscow. And that evening, another WOR news commentator, Gabriel Heater, took to the Mutual Network for this broadcast.
Gabriel Heater and his up-to-the-minute news of the world, presented by Four Hands Toothpaste.
Good evening, everyone. The last communique of World War II is in. Russia proclaims tomorrow as VE Day. The Russian people were told tonight for the first time of Germany's unconditional surrender. Moscow radio reports all terms laid down by General Eisenhower were ratified tonight in Berlin. Field Marshal Keitel and Admiral Friedberg signing for Germany in the presence of Lieutenant General Karl Spetz, Air Chief Marshal Sir Arthur Tedder, Field Marshal Zhukov and General de Tassinier. There was some anxiety in many quarters today when 10 hours went by without any proclamation in Moscow. Russia evidently waited for the official hour, 1:01 tonight, Eastern wartime. And Russia evidently waited for the ratification in Berlin, for the crowning hour of German humiliation, unconditional surrender in the capital where the war was planned. And they evidently waited for the final death rattle in Dresden and Prague, where the fighting came to an end but a few hours ago and surrender became official 1 hour ago. And now the guns are quiet everywhere in Europe, and the lights are on, and the hearts of men and women are lifted in thanksgiving as millions say tonight, "Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord." Peace in Europe. Peace in Europe. Hitler's war produced one photograph which belongs with those words, peace in Europe. A house in London had just been hit by a flying bomb. People were killed. Rescue work was going on. The picture shows a woman warden carrying out a child. The child crying, pressing its cheek on the woman's helmet, clasping her neck. There's fresh blood on the woman's hand. And the London newspaper which published that picture wrote these words. This picture tells us much. It tells us children were on the front line. It tells us it must never happen again. The guns are silent and the lights are on. And the people know the miracle has come to pass. Here's a forecast. My first after VE Day. Full victory over the Jap before President Truman is 62 years of age. He's 61 today. For the power now released for the grand assault on the Jap is staggering in weight beyond all human imagination. Hardly a man alive is able to compute all that crushing might. Never has any one nation ever had to face so great an avalanche in men, planes, ships, tanks, and guns. And all the weapons of war and the wrath of an outraged people. One more year for the Jap may prove to be a long time. Am I over-optimistic? Only 16 weeks ago, the Nazi had 7 or 8 million men, well-fed, well-armed, and well-entrenched. Von Rundstedt counterattacked in Belgium. And you and I heard people say we've lost a year in supplies. A year of war. That was 16 weeks ago, and unconditional surrender was ratified tonight in Berlin. There will be dramatic surprise in Japan as well. And reunion. Reunion here at home before many people believe possible now. Here's a headline for which I've been campaigning. I and others. No more Nazi prisoners are to be brought here except any who are now en route. Good. Use every possible inch of shipping space to furlough or discharge every man we can spare. Here's an item for the Jap. Hitler's contribution to the defeat of Japan. 300 U-boats, all said to be in good shape. Nazi U-boats. Said to be equipped with the latest device for long journeys. They're being turned over tonight to the Allies in good shape. Here's an echo of a long, long nightmare. Benito Mussolini's widow is a prisoner in Allied hands tonight. Well, the brownout is lifted here at home. The lights show in the Capitol building on the dome. And Mr. Vinson may have news tomorrow on the curfew, on the ban on horse racing, on gas and other matters. Meanwhile, Hitler's nose is rubbed good and hard in the mud of humiliation. Germany bans all Heil Hitler greetings, all Nazi salutes. And the number of German prisoners in American-British hands runs into so many millions. It may be more than the combined total of all American and British troops on all European battlefronts. If any army has ever suffered greater humiliation, I am unable to recall it. Peace in Europe. There'll be hundreds of headlines now, all rich in human interest. Things have come to pass which few living men thought probable. General de Gaulle with a price on his head. Shoot this man on sight, said the French quisling. Shoot this man on sight, said the Nazis. One man standing alone, calling to his countrymen to realize France had only lost the battle. Who would have said on that dark day when Hitler danced at Compiègne that de Gaulle would stand today in Notre Dame offering thanksgiving for the victory? That this one man standing alone would be the leader of his people in the great hour of victory. And the men who put a price on his head, fugitive or prisoner. Yes, headlines rich in human interest. You remember these words? 60,000 planes. 45,000 tanks. 8 million tons of shipping in a year, in our first year of war. Here are the results. 1942, 47,000 planes. 43, 85,000 planes. 44, 96,000 planes. In ships and tanks and guns, a free people made good its goal, fulfilled its promise to become the arsenal of democracy. A day may come when some men will say we need a strong man in America, as some men thought we did a few years ago. Remember those figures when it comes. This dedication of free men and women and free labor to the great task. Peace in Europe. 2 million men will come home within a year, in a shorter time perhaps. More than 1 million have come back now, men who bled for this great day. Even now, before the war is over, one hears of veterans who can't find jobs. Even now, one hears of employers who say this man may prove to be a liability in time. I had better drop him now. We gave our pledge. All that we are, we said, all that we can ever hope to be for these men. It was a pledge sanctified with the youth and flower of a great people. It was a pledge we gave in the darkest hour our people have ever known. Let us honor it. Thereby honor ourselves and prove we were worthy of it. In that same pledge we gave, we said there will be no discrimination because of race, creed, or color. We said we fight for this. We fight to prove we can live without prejudice and discrimination. Every man who fails to honor that pledge is fighting Hitler's war, even now. News generally travels by wireless, printing press, and radio, but it moves lightning fast, and its impact is powerful and violent. But an older medium carried today's news. There was no impact of violence. It was a church bell. And the news it brought reached into human hearts. I've heard people say we've always had war and we shall always have more war. And there just isn't anything we can do about it. And today one saw the long lines of men and women filing into houses of worship for prayer and thanksgiving. And one realized again, nothing will ever lift human hearts as high as a bell tolling its message in one word, peace. One had to be there to see it all and feel it. One had to be near the mother who fell to her knees and raised the careworn face to God and loud enough for all who were near to hear every word. Heard her say, O God, I've lost one boy. Bring my second back to me. O God, I need him so. Always have war because we've always had war. Because people just naturally drift from war to peace and back to war again. No, I'll never believe it. Yes, say the people have never found a way to conquer war. Say the people blunder into war. Say the people are betrayed into war. Say the people want peace so much when it comes, we give ourselves up to it so completely we forget all the vigilance we need not to be robbed of it in time. But don't say we've always had war because people want war. I've seen people in every kind of human circumstance and experience. I've seen people rescued from fire and flood and death itself. I've seen a nation come out of all the desperation of hard times and feel the exaltation of a job and security and the dignity it brought. But nothing in all human experience has ever moved men and women as a bell tolling that one word, peace. As it did today, even when peace had come only on one battlefield. Even when millions knew it was peace only in Europe. Even as millions knew all the peril and grief waiting on other fields of battle. Even as millions knew peace in Europe was only a brief flash of light in a long night. The people knew millions in Europe were homeless. And face famine and disease and all the plagues left by the horsemen of war. People knew the price it would take in toil and sweat before peace could mean anything, even in Europe. But the harvest of death was over on one battlefield, and human hearts were on fire. How can anybody say the people have always had war and would always have it? If all the nations now in conference at San Francisco could feel the great upsurge which came out of human hearts today, this would be the war to conquer war. Wherever people met, someone would say, you know, it isn't like 1918 at all. People are quiet. They're solemn. They feel it all just as deeply, but there isn't any celebrating, no exaltation. And you'd hear somebody reply, it's good to know the dying and over in Europe is over at least. But how are you going to celebrate when you know at this minute boys are dying on Okinawa? When you know the scourge of war will claim a frightful price before Japan is crushed. When you know how many who marched away to Europe are not coming back again. Our casualties, 750,000. If all the men at San Francisco could hear the people speak, they would know they carry a mandate as solemn as any delivered to men who ever came together. A mandate born in the hearts of millions who are trying to say, this pearl of great price, it was almost ours. A generation ago, this miracle called peace with the people fighting for it, praying for it. And willful men fought along party lines and fought each other over words, little realizing they were winning empty victories to be paid for with the lives of our sons one generation later. In a tiny church in England, a man and his wife waited all night for the dawn's day. There were many other nights when they were in that same church, when the whole world waited for the Nazis to land in Britain. And the church bells were to warn everybody the Nazis had come. Night after night, this man and his wife came, prepared to sound their alarm. And by the grace of God, the Nazi never came. But now the bell was to peal joyous news, tidings of victory and peace. The man turned to his wife and he said, I'll ring as I never rang before, with all my heart and all my strength until even our boy will hear it. Their boy would hear it in the cemetery hilltop, which was now his home. Here where his youth and dreams and his love were all sacrificed. I'll ring, said his father, as I never rang before. You and I, we'll fight for the peace as we've never fought before. Until every man whose responsibility it is will know this is our mandate. This is keeping faith with those who kept faith with us. Good night.
Thank you, Gabriel Heater. Gabriel Heater with up-to-the-minute news of the world was presented this evening by Four Hands Toothpaste, and he is heard Monday through Friday evenings at the same time, and Sunday evenings over most of these stations 15 minutes earlier. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Before Gabriel Heater made the broadcast we've just heard, CBS war correspondent Howard K. Smith toured what remained of Berlin. He had been stationed there before the war, and thus knew the city fairly well, or so he thought. On the 9th of May, he sent the following vivid word picture of the devastation to his colleagues back home.
This is Howard K. Smith reporting for the Combined American Networks. 3.5 years ago, I left Berlin by impolite request of the Nazi government. I thought it was a pretty crummy city that I gladly bade farewell to then. Yesterday, I went back. I went back to report on the Nazi capitulation to the Red Army and to us in the headquarters of Marshal Zhukov. But however great and important that historic event was, the thing that left me and all the other correspondents speechless before we ever reached the Marshal's headquarters was the sight of Berlin. It's still hard to make myself believe that it wasn't some dream. The city I knew is gone, rubbed out. It's the most massive work of concentrated destruction in history. I made a tour of Berlin this morning. It was a tour I shall never forget. What made this tour all the more interesting is that we went with men who did it. Air Chief Marshal of the RAF, Sir Arthur Tedder, and the Commander of America's Strategic Bombing Forces, General Carl Spatz. These two men, more than anybody else, have for 3 and 4 years planned and executed the annihilation of Berlin. Today, for the first time, they saw the results from the ground. They stood before the Reichstag and the Chancellery and the ruins of Unterdenlinden, and they said nothing. There were no words capable of encompassing that vast scene of desolation. Perhaps the best general impression I've heard expressed was that of a fellow correspondent who watched the wastelands that were once the Tiergarten Park for several minutes silently and then said, "It takes your breath away." Before landing at Tempelhof Airfield yesterday, we circled over the city twice. It's, generally speaking, the center of Berlin which has been truly flattened. For block after block and mile after mile of avenues and streets, there's nothing but roofless, hollow hulls of houses. Out around the fringes of town, the houses with their roofs still on become more numerous. But now and then, even out there, you run across a block that has literally been wiped out. Berlin was, in numbers of population, the fourth largest city in the world. In area, it's the second largest. The center of the town is a vast oval. The Wilhelmstrasse, the government street, runs from the perimeter straight into Unterdenlinden in the very middle of the city. We tried to get to the middle by following it this morning, but we couldn't. Rubble is so deep that in some places you couldn't even tell that a street had once been there. So we took a devious route to the center, twisting and winding through valleys of ruins. But the place was not just ruined. The ruins themselves had been pounded and repounded and repounded until there's no more rubble of bricks and parts of bricks. All there is left is dust, fine, powdery, pale red dust that you can sink down to the hubcaps in. The car ahead of us was just 50 yards away, and it was moving slowly. But it churned up so much dust that we couldn't see it. We had to tie handkerchiefs around our noses and mouths to keep the brick dust out. All over town, houses were still smoldering. Some of the fires were fresh fires, just begun by time bombs left behind in the ruins by the Nazis. The Russians said a few went off every day. An hour after we had arrived at Tempelhof Airfield, the main administration building of the airdrome burst into flame from one of these mines, and it burned all through the night. After a long, twisting ride through desolate stretch, our convoy stopped at what appeared in the dim outlines of the wreckage to have been once a large traffic circle. I got out and tried to orient myself, but there was nothing familiar. There was a sign there in Russian. After a little while, I made out the Cyrillic letters. This was Alexanderplatz, one of the main and best-known intersections toward the center of Berlin. I got my bearings from a cleared street and was able to pick out in the rubble the notorious Gestapo prison. Once Dick Hottolet, an American war correspondent, had been locked there, and I had tried vainly to visit him. It was a massive red brick structure then. Now it was chewed down to a nub of a foundation, and the bricks were black with soot. On the corner there had been, I remembered, an enormous 18-feet-high bronze statue of buxom Berolina, the patron goddess of Berlin. There was nothing but the pedestal left now. Berolina herself was just so much shattered and half-molten scrap. From there we made our way to the direct center. I kept my eyes open for domes and towers, old familiar landmarks to guide us, but there were none. The skyline was a jagged silhouette, no section of it different from any other section. I know that part of Berlin as well as I know my own bedroom, but I didn't recognize any of it without having to think back and from familiar patches of familiar buildings try and reconstruct it in my mind. we stopped at Kaiser Wilhelm's massive palace at the east end of Unter den Linden. Its roof had been raked off as if by a gigantic knife. Its front portico, where the people of Berlin heard from Kaiser Wilhelm the joyous news that the First World War had broken out, was a steep hill of wreckage. The Lustgarten, the big square out in front of the palace, where Hitler used to stage his big open-air demonstrations, was plowed with craters. On Unter den Linden, the famous broad thoroughfare that divides Berlin into northern and southern halves, it was a silent valley of empty, crushed hulls of houses. All the hideous old architectural monuments to Prussianism, the old arsenal where Hitler used to speak once a year on Heroes Memorial Day, the State Opera House, the university, the famous cafes and the embassies were complete, indistinguishable ruins. The Adlon Hotel, where Hitler and Ribbentrop used to lodge visiting heads of state, had been provisionally picked out as a press headquarters, should American correspondents ever set up in Berlin again. We had been told it was virtually intact. Well, it isn't. Only three of its six or seven floors remained, and they were burnt black inside. About the only landmark that was still up and recognizable was the Brandenburg Gate at the west end of Berlin. Its pillars were gashed and broken. On top of it, the bronze statue of Victoria in her horse-drawn chariot of triumph was distorted and mangled, but you could still orient yourself by it. Beyond the gate is the Tiergarten, the vast park of central Berlin. Once it was a beautiful forest park. Today it looks like nothing so much as parts of the famous Hürtgen Forest south of Aachen, where American and German troops fought one of the bitterest battles of the war for months. The trees were chewed, twisted trunks without branches or leaves. The earth was plowed with craters. The Nazis tried to make a last stand in the Tiergarten, and they and their once lovely park were chewed to shreds. We went down the Wilhelmstrasse from Unter den Linden. Ribbentrop's bright yellow Foreign Office was black. Through its windows, you could see daylight on the other side. The propaganda ministry is literally leveled. We stopped at Hitler's Chancellery, the enormous, supposedly bomb-proof center from which a decade of history has been dictated. At the front door, there was a bomb crater big enough to hide a truck in. Symbolically, half of a geographic globe, slightly battered and with bullet holes in it, lay at the bottom of the crater. It had belonged to Hitler. He probably inflamed his imagination for purposes of global strategy by considering it back in the old days. The Russians had found it in his study and had thrown it out of the window into the crater. The bomb-proof chancellery was, like so many other Nazi creations, a myth. There were yawning holes in the ceiling. One crater, right inside the entrance of the great marble hall, reached deep down through two floors of the cellar. A bronze bust of Hitler with a bullet hole through its forehead lay in the dusty ruins down in the cellar. The Führer's garden had apparently been fought for, too. There was not a patch of green on its pocked, scarred surface. General Sokolovsky, deputy commander to Marshal Zhukov, who had come with us on the trip, said the body of Goebbels and his wife and children had been found here. We asked about Hitler's body. The general smiled and said at least six bodies of Hitler had been offered to the Red Army by Germans. None of them were in recognizable state. It was hard to believe that this scarred wreck was the famed headquarters of Hitler. In fact, it was, and it is still hard to believe that it was Berlin I saw. It's like something out of a distorted dream. In the valleys of ruin, we saw not a single German. It was hard to believe that human beings had ever lived here. The parts of Berlin that were not badly beaten seemed to be more Russian than German. There were Russian signs all over the streets, Russian vehicles, and red flags. There were Russian soldiers and Russian civilians attached to the army on all the streets. What remained of Berlin seemed to have altered its nationality and its atmosphere. The pervasive and unmistakable odor of Russian gasoline added to the illusion. Now, right in the middle of the map of Berlin, in the Tiergarten, a monument is being erected. It was half finished this morning when we passed. It's a tribunal of many columns. And in Russian characters on each column is printed the name of a Nazi victim. Austria, Czechoslovakia, Norway, Denmark, and so on. It's a monument to the United Nations, and it's Russian. Berlin, the Prussian capital, with a Prussian atmosphere thick enough to cut, no longer exists. I don't know what to call the ruined city I saw today, but it was not Berlin. I return you now to New York.
That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.